Highland Falls, El Paso, Clarksville, Watertown, and from other important military capitals around the globe, Eye on Defense brings the top military and defense issues into focus. Eye on Defense is proudly sponsored by Big Sarge Pre-Owned TA-50 Emporium and The Last Hope Jewelry and Pawn. And now, citizens of Earth, brace yourselves for the next episode of Eye on Defense. Defense, 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 defense.
Excuse me. All right, we're back. It's 25 March, and this is episode 247, I do believe. I won't start off with the CENTCOM X, but we'll get to that. I'll start off with the, I think what the big news is the U.S. Security Council resolution today, 25 March. This is from UN News and a little bit from Axios. The UN Security Council today, Monday, passed a resolution, you heard that correctly, demanding an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan, which ends 9 April, I think, on or about 9 April. The immediate and conditional release of hostages and the urgent need to expand the flow of aid into Gaza. There are 14 votes in favor, with the United States abstaining, therefore it passed. A little bit from Axios here. This is why it matters. This is the first resolution demanding a ceasefire to pass at the UN at the Security Council over four previous failures. The United States abstained rather than using its veto. All other members voted in favor. And real quick, the Council, of course, is 15 members. There are five permanent members: China, France, Russia, United Kingdom, and United States. There are 10 non-permanent members. Currently, they are Algeria, Ecuador, Guyana, Japan, Malta, Mozambique, Republic of Korea, Sierra Leone, Slovenia, and Switzerland. The UN Security Council adopts a resolution tabled by the 10 non-permanent members, E10, demanding a ceasefire in Gaza during Ramadan. The vote was 14 to none. One abstention, the United States. Resolution 2728 calls for the immediate release of hostages and for ensuring humanitarian access to Gaza. The Council rejected a Russia proposal amendment that would have called for a permanent ceasefire. The U.S. Ambassador says delegation fully supports the critical objectives of the draft. Algeria's ambassador says the ceasefire will end the bloodbath. Ambassador for the Observer State of Palestine says this must be a turning point. And then the Gilad Erdan, the ambassador and permanent representative of Israel, questioned why the Security Council discriminates among victims, recalling it to condemn the deadly attack on a concert hall in Moscow on Friday, but failed to condemn the Nova Music Festival massacre of 7 October. Civilians, no matter where they live, deserve to enjoy music and safety and security, and the Security Council should have the moral clarity to condemn such acts of terror equally without discrimination. Sadly, today as well, this council refused to condemn the 7 October massacre. This is a disgrace. So that's kind of a big deal, very heavy, because the United States did not veto it. And I think there's some heat between Israel and the United States right now over this. And here's an article from Times of Israel from today. Perplexed by overreaction, White House says PM, Prime Minister Netanyahu, stirring crisis in U.S.-Israel ties. Let's see, Jacob McGibb. The White House suggested on Monday, today, that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to manufacture a crisis in U.S.-Israel ties after he canceled plans to send an Israeli delegation to Washington over the Biden administration's decision to allow the adoption of the UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire and hostage release, which we just talked about. Prime Minister Netanyahu said the U.S. abstention marks a divergence from Washington policy linking a ceasefire to Hamas releasing hostages abducted on 7 October, but U.S. officials asserted this was not their interpretation of the resolution and that their position in favor of that conditionally has not changed. So the White House National Security spokesman John Kirby, who I referred to once as weasel-like, no offense to the weasel population out there, he is kind of a weaselly guy. He came out and said all these kind of things. I'll just tell you his quotes. Here's a quote. It seems like the prime minister's office, Netanyahu, is choosing to create a perception of daylight here where they don't need to do that. That's from White House National Security Council John Kirby. We're kind of perplexed by this. It's a non-binding resolution, so there's no impact at all on Israel's ability to continue to go after Hamas, Kirby said. We're kind of perplexed by this. I think Kirby's just playing stupid, playing dumb up there, like, well, we don't understand why Israel's mad, but that we didn't veto this. It's kind of insulting that he doesn't understand. I think he understands. He's just being a weasel-like guy, right? Moving on, the second U.S. official. This article refers to a second U.S. official over and over. Doesn't say who it is. A second U.S. official briefing a small group of reporters added that Biden's aides had been in touch with their Israeli counterparts in the days and hours leading to the vote, explained it would not amount to a change in U.S. approach. This second U.S. official said Israeli officials understood this, but Prime Minister Netanyahu decided to present things differently. That's, of course, from the U.S. side of it. For its part, Prime Minister Netanyahu's office said U.S. abstention was, quote, a clear retreat from the position Washington had held since the beginning of the war. The statement continues, this hurts both the war effort and the effort to release the hostages because it gives Hamas hope that international pressure will allow them to accept a ceasefire without the release of the hostages. The statement added that Netanyahu had warned the United States ahead of time that he would cancel Israeli plans for Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer and National Security Council Chairman Hanegbi, hope I said his name right, to visit Washington if the United States abstained in the vote, and that he was merely following through. Again, the second unnamed U.S. official said that Netanyahu's decision to cancel the delegation was likely motivated by Israeli domestic politics. Of course it was. Kirby was pressed on whether Biden was not influenced by his own domestic politics. And the answer, of course it is, but that's not what Kirby said. The White House spokesman rejected the idea outright, saying Biden's decisions regarding the Israel-Hamas war are based strictly on national security concerns. Again, insulting the reader here. Pressed on whether the U.S. might now begin conditioning aid to Israel, Kirby indicated that is not in the cards. Here's some more quotes from John Kirby. I would take issue with this idea that we're not leveraging everything we can, but it's not a leveraging exercise. It's not about trying to use some sort of power dynamics here with our good friend and ally Israel. It's about helping them to defend themselves. We still have Israel's back. As you and I are speaking, we are providing tools, capabilities, and weapon systems so that Israel can defend itself against what we agree is a viable threat from Hamas. John Kirby doth protest too much. U.S. President Joe Biden has no immediate plans to call Netanyahu about the latter's decision to cancel the top aide's visit, nor did Netanyahu call Biden about it in advance, the unnamed mystery second U.S. official said. Almost done here. We're disappointed that the Israeli delegation won't be coming to Washington, D.C. to allow us to have a fulsome. I don't know what that means, fulsome. Writing that down. Fulsome prison blues, a fulsome conversation on the viable alternatives to going in on the ground in Rafah, Kirby said. The Biden administration will still have some opportunities to present its alternatives to a major Rafah offensive during those meetings with visiting Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, even though those will not be a replacement for the interagency gathering it was hoping to hold with some of Netanyahu's other top aides this week, acknowledged Kirby. And I'll stop right there. I mean, don't act dumb. You know why they're pissed. moving on. So now we'll get to the CENTCOM X, March 23, Red Sea update from 2:50 to 4:30 a.m. local time. The Iranian-backed Houthis launched 4 anti-ship ballistic missiles into the Red Sea vicinity of MV Huang Pu, Panamanian flag, Chinese-owned, big deal there, Chinese-operated tanker. At 4:25 p.m., a 5th ballistic missile was detected as it was firing toward the ship, same ship. The ship issued a distress call but not request assistance. The MV Huang Pu suffered minimal damage, and a fire on board was extinguished in 30 minutes. No casualties reported. The vessel resumed its course. The Houthis attacked this ship despite previously stating it would not attack Chinese vessels. Between 6:50 a.m. and 9:50 a.m. local time, U.S. forces, including the USS Kearney, DDG-64, engaged 6 Houthi unmanned aerial vehicles over the southern Red Sea, 5 crashed in the sea, 1 flew inland into Houthi-controlled areas of Yemen. So that's our latest CENTCOM Twitter X for CENTCOM. Already, Agnes Helou from Breaking Defense has done a story on this Chinese strike. Johnny on the spot. Purported Houthi strike on Chinese vessel in Red Sea likely a mistake, say experts. This is from Breaking Defense. In a first, the Houthi rebel group in Yemen attacked a Chinese vessel twice with anti-ship ballistic missiles, according to U.S. CENTCOM, less than a week after the group reportedly pledged not to target Chinese and Russian ships. Analysts told Breaking Defense the attack was likely a mistake, but was evident of evidence of the potential for errors in a crowded Red Sea where fears of escalation are ever present. In the very early morning hours on Saturday, the Houthis purportedly fired four anti-ship ballistic missiles close to the MV Huangpu. We talked about this, a Chinese oil tanker, according to CENTCOM. 12 hours later, a fifth missile was fired toward the vessel. For months now, the Iran-backed group has fired rockets, missiles, and drones targeting all manners of commercial shipping in the Red Sea, but appeared to make a point not to interfere with Chinese ships. Last week, Bloomberg reported that Houthis had reached a specific agreement with China and Russia to avoid harming their vessels. Asked about this purported deal, a spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry said on Friday, the Red Sea is an important international trade route for goods and energy. China calls on relevant parties to jointly protect the safety of the shipping lanes in the Red Sea in accordance with the law and earnestly respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the coastal countries along the Red Sea. This is the same spokesman. China will continue to play a constructive role in making contribution to the early restoration of peace and stability in the Red Sea. China has stayed on the sidelines when it comes to various military coalitions in the Red Sea, joining neither the U.S.-led Operation Prosperity Guardian nor the European Union, UNNAFOR Aspides, whatever that is. Beijing has individually resorted to escorting its ships along the Red Sea. I'll stop there. Next, we'll do some Ukraine stuff. Spain to send 19 more Leopard 2 A4 tanks to Ukraine. 25 March, the Spanish Ministry of Defense has announced a plan to send 19 Leopard 2 A4 tanks to Ukraine by September to strengthen its defenses against Russia in the ongoing war. General Dynamics European Land Systems has been chosen to provide all the commissioning services for the tanks. All units will undergo overhaul and maintenance procedures, replacing any defective parts and reassembling its systems to ensure full operation and effectiveness before being sent to Kiev. Work for the vehicles will be carried out in Seville. The delivery is the second batch of Leopard tanks sent from Madrid to Ukraine following the initial transfer of six tanks in 2023. Real quick on the Leopard. Leopard is a third-generation main battle tank. Its main armor is 120mm smoothbore gun, and the Spanish Army currently has 55 active Leopard 2 A4s. What's next? One more story from Ukraine. The Estonian government has announced additional aid, military aid for Ukraine, worth $22 million. The package includes $22 million U.S. dollars, $20 million euro. The package includes artillery, ammunition, and other capabilities deemed critical, such as gas masks, explosives, recoilless anti-tank guns, sniper rifles, and small caliber ammunition. The artillery shell donation comprises 155mm shells and will be delivered as part of Tallinn's contribution to the EU 1 million round replenishment effort for Ukraine. Denmark will partially finance the rounds under the latest tranche the government added. In 2023, Estonia pledged sniper rifles and special forces equipment. Estonia also announced a donation of 155mm howitzers in addition to ammunition and Carl Gustav anti-tank grenade launchers the same year. I don't think Carl G is a grenade launcher, but you know what it is. What's next? Tim Martin, Breaking Defense, United Kingdom reveals sovereign, quote, sovereign nuclear warhead name, Astraea, A-S-T-R-A-E-A. I guess that's what they're naming this round, this munition, Astraea. I mean, couldn't they come up with a better name than that? I guess. Here we go. Tim Martin, 25 March, Britain's new nuclear warhead program has been dubbed the A21/Mark 7, or Astraea, A-S-T-R-A-E-A. What the hell is that? A national nuclear deterrent strategy reveal for the first time. It's replacing the Trident system for a subs, right? You can't get better than a name for a warhead than the Trident, right? Now they've replaced it with Astraea. Maybe I'm missing something. Anyway, the future warhead to replace the submarine Trident launch systems will be developed as a sovereign, quote, sovereign capability, and, quote, in parallel with the United States W93 MK7 warhead, according to the Defense Nuclear Enterprise Command paper. The document did not disclose a cost estimate for the replacement warhead or a timeline for entry into service, though the UK has previously said the weapon system will be available, quote, available in the 2030s. It is also unclear if a final design for the A21 MK warhead has been approved for the Astraea. London first announced the replacement warhead program in February of 2020 and later said the requirements, design, and manufacture of these weapons will meet our obligations under the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. The decision to validate the warhead design features and capabilities without carrying out underground nuclear tests is in keeping with the voluntary British moratorium on nuclear weapon explosions. The Atomic Weapons Establishment, the UK's nuclear weapons manufacturing and research organizations, will instead rely on simulation, modeling, supercomputers, and lasers to develop Astraea, noted the deterrence document, which falls in line with how the United States has digitally designed and tested new nuclear weapons for years. This part I did not know. The UK operates a policy of continuous at-sea deterrence, meaning its nuclear strike capability is singular in nature or submarine-based only, as opposed to the deployment of air or air-launched grounds or air-launched weapon systems as other nuclear powers, like the United States has the Triad, right? UK's only got the submarine one. UK Parliamentary Library states that the UK has a nuclear stockpile ceiling, quote, of 260 warheads, but that exact figure is unclear. A 2023 estimate from the United States-based Federation of American Scientists put the UK at 225 warheads, of which 120 are believed to be deployed. While we're talking about Navy stuff and continuing with our budget, this is the U.S. Navy's unfunded priorities list. I think we've done the Marines and we've done the Army. I was going to do the Air Force tonight, but in sticking with the last story we did about the Navy, UK Navy submarine, I thought I'd do the U.S. Navy. Really nice story here. Megan Eckstein, Defense News. Navy wish list seeks Red Sea missiles back submarine industrial base. U.S. Navy sent lawmakers a $2.2 billion wish list for FY25. Here it is. The unfunded priorities list supplements the $257.6 billion budget request, is asking for 13 items, ranging from repairs of infrastructure on Guam to buying another KC-130J transport plane for the Navy Reserve to accelerating classified program development. The number one priority on the list is a $403 million to invest in the submarine industrial base. Next, the list also includes $92.9 million to address how quickly it's been shooting SM-2, Standard Missile 2 weapons to knock down the Houthi-launched missiles and drones in the Red Sea. So all those news on CENTCOM-X about the destroyers in the Red Sea blasting UAVs and stuff like that, they're using SM-2 missiles. This money would procure SM Block 3 and Block 3 Alpha Bravo recertification materials to address a backlog of these older missiles that need to be recertified before they can be used in combat in the Red Sea. Next, the Sea Service also wants $50 million to buy four more MK-48 heavyweight torpedoes, which the service calls a priority for long-range maritime fires. Next, they want $208 million for aviation readiness, including four F-35C engines to support deployed carrier wings. They want Super Hornet Block 3 upgrades and MQ-25 Stingray carrier-based tanker drone initial deployment activities. Next, for the Surface Force, they want $200 million to reduce cannibalization of parts on destroyers and critical surface warfare systems. Next, $75.3 million for subsea and seabed warfare payload for the Navy's Tetra remotely operated vehicle, which completed its critical design review in November. Next, they want $184 million to accelerate the development of payload for the Orca extra large undersea, unmanned undersea vessel, vehicle, sorry. It also seeks to combine $90 million to accelerate two classified programs, Copperfield and Grandstand, whatever those are. Next, it wants $105.5 million to accelerate the development of communications equipment for the Strategic Deterrence Fleet. Two more. Next, it wants $109.9 million to develop and procure long-endurance electronic decoy countermeasure system. And finally, they request $1.5 billion in military construction products and projects, including upgrades and repairs to hangar facilities in Guam, a dry dock, and a water treatment plant in Hawaii, and an aviation training complex in Nevada. Very nice article by Megan Eckstein. And one last article. Short but sweet. We haven't talked about this for a while. The next generation squad weapon for the U.S. Army. U.S. Army to build an ammo factory for the next generation squad weapon in Missouri. Wrote Jeff Manuel, 25 March. U.S. Army has awarded Olin Winchester a contract to establish a new ammunition manufacturing facility in Missouri for the next generation squad weapon. I'm not from Missouri, but you can show me. The next generation squad weapon is unveiled in 2017 to increase warfighters' accuracy and lethality by replacing their handheld assault rifles with modernized variants. Basically, one's going to replace the M4, one's going to replace the M249 SAW. We've already talked about this a million times. I think this thing's called the M7 that's going to replace the M4. And the new SAW, M249, is going to be called the M250. Under this agreement, the Clayton-based company will build a center in Independence City, Missouri, to produce ammunition for the upcoming next-generation squad weapon rifle and automatic rifle variants. Of course, it's 6.8 ammunition. The decision to construct the hub followed an 18-month design phase focusing on the building's architecture and corresponding systems. The conceptualization involved layouts to accommodate processes, best practice manufacturing methodologies, and equipment, securing the efficiency, maintainability, and readiness of the area for future requirements. Once completed, the factory will incorporate solutions for metal parts assembly, shell loading, charging, packaging, testing laboratories, and quality control. In 2023, the Army announced plans to procure 18,000 next-generation squad weapons. It doesn't say the makeup. And then the Vortex, of course, is the other effort. That's the fire control. They were awarded a $20 million framework to fabricate 250,000 of these of fire controls. So that's a lot of fire controls. So the assumption is the fire control can go on both the automatic rifle and the rifle, and there's 250,000 fire controls. So the assumption is that's how many of those weapons are going to make. Anyway, that's the assumption. All right, short episode, 23 minutes, but we got a lot packed in there. This is episode 247 of the books. Thank you very much for listening and good night.